Live from CDC headquarters in Atlanta, this is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. So if you have the following symptoms, you should go see a doctor. Sudden chills followed by feverish sweats for days on end, joint pain, headaches, waves of nausea. You are probably not feeling those things, though. And for that, you can thank the institution where I am now sitting. 70 years ago, malaria was so bad in the southern United States that a new government agency was formed in Atlanta to fight the disease.
Remember, there is only one cause of malaria, the mosquito. Destroy the mosquito and you will wipe out the disease. Then, in place of sickness and poverty, there will be health, safety, and happiness.
The battle against malaria led the organization to many other causes, like sexually transmitted diseases, tuberculosis in the 1950s and 60s. Today, we have the country's foremost public health institute right here on Clifton Road in Georgia's DeKalb County. And we are here to celebrate the 70th birthday of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's a special show for us because we get to honor the work of the people who work every day to keep us safe from global health threats. Many of them are in the room with me right now. So let's hear from you. Good morning, CDC. We will start things off with an update on CDC research from the person in charge. CDC Director Tom Frieden is with us today. And if you have questions for him or any of today's guests, you can tweet it to us. It's at OST Talk with the hashtag CDC70. So, Director Frieden, thank you so much for being with us today and happy birthday.
Well, welcome to CDC and thanks for doing this.
You look great for 70. To start off on a sobering note, I mean, in light of the news that we've had over the past week, and especially last night from Dallas, one of the things we've talked about a number of times in the show and sometimes with employees from the CDC is whether or not we can get good research on guns as a public health issue. And I wonder what kind of questions you think we could answer should Congress free up funding for that kind of research.
Understanding firearm violence is important in order to prevent firearm injuries and death. And over the past few years, we've asked Congress for $10 million a year to do research into firearm violence in things that I think everyone can agree on, such as reducing injuries to children through the unintentional exposure to violence or to guns. But until Congress funds that, we're not able to do that type of research.
Which is a difficult situation for a scientist when you have to make a political argument in order to make scientific research. How does that complicate your work?
We try to stick to the facts. We are America's agency that protects Americans from threats, whether they're infectious or non-infectious. And we understand that ultimately many decisions do depend on politics. We try to stay out of that and provide the best available information so the decisions can be taken that are most likely to protect Americans.
So let's go back. The CDC has had some incredible victories. I mean, we already spoke about malaria, which can only be described as a huge public health triumph. Then there's also the fight against polio. What do you learn from things like that, malaria and polio, that help you when you confront things like Ebola and Zika?
CDC has had seven decades of firsts, and while we have had a lot of progress against malaria, including saving millions of lives over the past decade, that part of the President's Malaria Initiative, it's still a major problem around the world. So one sobering lesson is that our work is not done. The only area where our work is done is really just about smallpox, because in smallpox we were able, working with a global coalition, to eradicate it from the world forever. And a disease that killed hundreds of millions of people should never again kill anyone. And we don't have to vaccinate against it either, in general. Now, we are a little bit concerned as a potential bioweapon, so I've got a little footnote on smallpox. But we're also very close to that with polio. We're at the finish line of the eradication of effort on polio.
And that's close, when you say close, what does that mean?
We have gone from 350,000 children disabled by polio each year when we began the effort in 1988 to 74 cases last year. And it's only present in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we hope we'll be able to get over the finish line there possibly this year.
So let's go back to Ebola, and it appears that the fight against the current strain of Ebola is largely mostly successful. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that. But I wonder what kind of lessons you take away from that, and especially in terms of communicating with the public. What kind of things can you improve?
First off, it's key to recognize that Ebola didn't have to be as bad as it was. If the countries of West Africa had had core public health services, it wouldn't have become an epidemic. It could have been stopped there, as it was stopped in many countries in Africa, because we had strengthened their disease detection and control programs. So the first thing to understand about Ebola is that it didn't have to be this bad. The second thing to understand is that it could have been much, much worse. If Ebola had gotten out of control in Lagos, Nigeria, where there was a cluster of cases, it could have exploded all over Africa, and we could still be dealing with it.
Now, because the population is so large and so dense.
Absolutely. This is the first time we've seen an urban Ebola epidemic, and that was in Monrovia and other parts of West Africa. But it didn't get into Nigeria, which has 10 times the travel and a much larger population. If it had gotten out of control in Lagos, it likely would have spread throughout Nigeria and elsewhere. So I think that the really three things we have to know are, first, every country needs to be able to find a health threat when it emerges and stop it quickly. Second, when a country is overwhelmed, we as a world have to be able to surge in rapidly and stop it before it becomes a regional or global crisis. And third, healthcare infection control, preventing the spread of infections in hospitals, is really important and not easy. And we need to do a better job of that all over the world.
Now, here's where we get into some of the more modern complications, especially because when it comes to getting people to get the vaccines they need, to getting people to understand symptoms, and frankly, to be afraid of the right things, that requires you educating the public. And I find it interesting that now we have people who are called science interpreters that are sort of interpreting science for the scientists to make it palatable to the public. How do you bridge that communication gap?
Well, I think all of us need to be better at stating things clearly. We shouldn't hide behind fancy words.
Right.
But at the same time, we shouldn't oversimplify. There are things that are complex, and sometimes people want a simple answer, and there isn't a simple answer. Or people want a definitive answer, and there isn't a definitive answer. Let me give a modern-day example. We're dealing with Zika.
Yeah.
Zika's a new threat. We have never before identified a mosquito-borne disease that could cause a birth defect. Never happened before. And literally, every single day, we're learning more about Zika. At the same time, we have to give recommendations today based on the best available evidence today. So we're in the position of saying, here's what we know as of today, here's what we don't know, here's what we're doing to find out, but this is our recommendation and this is what we're doing to find out more. And tomorrow we could change that recommendation if we learn more. That can be very frustrating to people, but that's how science works. That's how the world works.
So what is your biggest challenge? Knowing that sometimes that challenge changes from year to year, just like the flu vaccine seems to change from year to year. I know that we're not always great at predicting what flu is going to come up, but I wonder what's the biggest obstacle you have?
I think the biggest obstacle we have at CDC is that what we do is really good for everyone somewhat. But it's not something
it's
that...
It's not a great tagline. No. What we do is really good for everyone,
but let me
kinda.
Let me finish. We work 24/7 protecting Americans. And when we're successful, you don't see what we do. And the efforts that we undertake are efforts that are needed everywhere and all the time. It's a round-the-clock monitoring, response, investigation, prevention. Many years ago, a great public health leader said, public health is purchasable. Within natural limitations, a community can determine its own death rate. But that means that a community needs to come together, and whether it's clean water 100 years ago, or clean air, or ensuring high vaccination rates, these are things that all of society benefits from. But the advocates for this, the people who recognize this and will forcefully push it in when it comes to funding or regulatory advances that keep people safer, that's something that doesn't necessarily have a strong lobby, if you will. So we lack the kind of strong advocates that some individual causes have for the general strengthening of public health. That may be a philosophical or political analysis, but I think that is
complicated.
But I do think that is our biggest challenge. We're fortunate that there are many people in Congress who do understand how important CDC is, who do understand that we are about keeping Americans safe and healthy, that we're a best buy. But the way our political system works, it may be difficult for us to do things that have specific major benefits because the advocacy for them isn't as forceful as the advocacy for some other things.
And the answers aren't as simple.
Well, sometimes they are, right? Don't smoke. That's pretty simple.
But one that seems a simple, something like obesity is not good for you, ends up being complicated because we get very different answers from different scientists about how to eat properly, right? I mean, nutrition seems to be very complicated and up for debate.
There are, broadly speaking, two types of things that we could consider doing. One is proven policies. It's just a matter of the political or financial will to implement them. And there are lots of those that could save a lot of lives. That's why, for example, we launched the Million Hearts Initiative. We can prevent a million heart attacks and strokes over a five-year period by doing what's proven to work but not being done today. There are also areas, including obesity, where we don't have all of the answers. And in those areas, it really makes a lot of sense to try things and see what works. We talk about evidence-based practices, but we also need practice-based evidence where we try something, see if it works, and if it does, we learn from that. Now, there are some areas within nutrition where there is not reasonable doubt. For example, artificial trans fats increase your risk of a heart attack and don't have any benefit. You can get rid of them without altering the taste, increasing the cost, or doing anything else negative, and you're going to save a lot of lives. Reducing sodium is very clearly indicated. And reducing sodium can be done in ways that people don't miss it. The only thing they'll not experience is a heart attack or stroke.
We have a couple minutes left, and I wonder, does the CDC have the funding that it needs to cover all of the possible things that might kill us?
I think you heard from our local audience the response
a
to that.
A laugh is not a comment.
We take seriously that every dollar we spend is a dollar that somebody worked hard to earn. And we take seriously our role as diligent stewards of the funds entrusted to us. Public health is a best buy. If you look at immunization, every dollar we spend saves $3 in healthcare costs and $10 in societal costs. And many
of our... Could you go back and say that again? Every dollar that you spend on public health prevention?
On immunization specifically, and many of our other programs have a similar return on investment, or ROI. Every dollar we spend returns $3 in healthcare savings and $10 in societal savings.
Oh.
We are a best buy, and the more resources Congress entrusts in us, the more we can empower Americans to live longer, healthier, more productive lives.
It's a bargain. That is Tom Frieden. He is the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. Today we are live from the headquarters of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It is the 70th anniversary of the CDC. In all that time, the public health agency has done a lot more than research and vaccinations. The CDC has also captured the imagination of some TV writers and filmmakers. Reporter Sean Powers takes us through a brief history of a government institution turned Hollywood star.
Oh. We're 5 minutes into this movie, and there's already a dead body.
Drum? Nah, shot twice. Must have crawled on this thing.
Recognize him?
Nah, he ain't from around here. Some kind of foreigner.
These poor cops think this unsolved murder is the worst of their problems. They're worried about bullet holes when they should be worried about the bubonic plague.
I'm Dr. Reed of the United States Public Health Service, and one of the jobs of my department is to keep plague out of this country.
You know, if he's here, it's not good.
Now, I may be an alarmist, I may be entirely wrong about the whole matter, but I've seen this disease work. And I'm telling you, if it ever gets loose, it can spread over the entire country.
Dr. Reed is indeed an alarmist.
What can we do?
He's the main character in the 1950 film noir Panic in the Streets.
We can have them watched, we know who they are, all but one. The man who killed him, or men.
This was one of the first movies to feature an agency like the CDC, which was 4 years old the year this movie came out. Well, an expert on the plague won't help us now. No, what we need is an expert on movies.
My name is Stephen Brown. I am chief film critic for SilverScreenCapture.com.
Stephen lives in Atlanta and reviews movies as a hobby on his website. I asked him to compile a list of some of the classics inspired by the CDC.
In various forms over the years, in cinema culture, CDC has become less a specific government organization than a state of mind. There's always been intrepid scientists trying to look for ways to fight against time, fight against the virus, fight against the pod people.
I'll be damned.
No wonder they didn't bleed. It's clotted throughout the entire system. 5 quarts of blood turned to powder.
In theory, I suppose a single organism could do it.
But in fact, there isn't an organism on Earth.
You mean there didn't used to be?
That's a scene from the 1971 science fiction thriller The Andromeda Strain, which was based on a novel by Michael Crichton. A team of scientists tries to stop a deadly alien virus that wipes out a small town. Stephen Brown says, in these earlier films that tackle CDC-esque issues, you don't hear CDC mentioned by name.
Only in the past 2 or 3 decades has the CDC actually been called out as something that people discuss and talk about as an entity, shorthand for the disease-fighting warriors.
And no one represents disease-fighting warriors more than our brain-bashing, skull-crushing heroes in The Walking Dead. The show actually features an episode at the CDC where a lone researcher tries to learn more about what's turned humanity into bloodthirsty zombies. One of the main characters finds out the key to the outbreak.
What? Of the CDC, Jenner told me. Whatever it is, we all carry it.
In recent years, zombie flicks like World War Z, I Am Legend, and 28 Days Later have mixed together the undead and public health in an end-of-the-world recipe. CDC Museum Director Judy Gant says it's interesting how these depictions resonate with audiences.
We've had people come into the museum and seriously ask, not kids, but adults, seriously ask, where do you keep the zombies? And we have laughed and said, oh, you know, that's just TV. No, you can tell me, where really are the zombies?
But accuracy matters in some plots, like in the 2011 movie Contagion, which was about the race to stop an airborne virus.
Hello?
Hello? Mr. Barnes?
Yes.
This is Dr. Mears from the Centers for Disease Control. I believe you may have had contact with Beth Emhoff last week.
The filmmakers behind Contagion talked with the CDC about accuracy.
How are you feeling today?
Pretty cruddy, to be honest. Head is pounding. I probably picked up some sort of bug.
Where are you right now?
Other filmmakers give Kate Fulb a call. She oversees Hollywood Health and Society at the University of Southern California. Think of it as the arm between Hollywood and the CDC.
If you're a half-hour show, you actually have about 22 minutes to tell your entire story. And within that time, you've got people to kill and murders to be solved and love stories to, you know, there's a lot of other stuff going on besides the health information.
But Kate says that doesn't mean health information should take a back seat. Her and her team provide the entertainment industry with accurate and timely information about things like public health research, climate change, and CDC clothing and equipment.
Viewers actually learn a lot about health information through their favorite television programs. And they actually learn this information and believe it more so from popular narrative programs than they do from the news or commercials or PSAs.
And that leaves the question, what will be Hollywood's next public health crisis? Will it be the race to stop the Zika virus or Ebola, or an even greater menace that we haven't dreamed up yet?
We're heading to the CDC. If there's anything left, it's got to be there, don't you think?
For GPB News, I'm Sean Powers in Atlanta.
Fears of outbreak and government cover-ups are not just confined to movie scripts. A 2014 survey by two University of Chicago researchers found half of Americans subscribe to at least one medical conspiracy theory. Those beliefs actually have a powerful effect on how people take care of both themselves and their families. And here to talk about that is Sean Ritchie. He's a political science professor at Georgia State University. Good morning, Ed and Sean.
Good morning.
And also with us is Sinead Young. She's an associate professor of psychology at Morehouse College. Hi, Sinead.
Good morning.
So you're here to tell me why we believe this stuff when the facts conflict with it, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So why?
So oftentimes people are trying to make meaning of the world around them, and we may not always have all of the evidence that supports valid claims.
Wait, this sounds like the beginning of Greek mythology.
It often is.
But what that it also holds true that when we see information that conflicts with what we believe, we still go with what we believe and not the facts.
Why
is that?
That is absolutely human nature. Often we have a belief system, and even when we have evidence of the contrary, it's really difficult to change those beliefs.
Okay, so let's talk about anti-vaxxing, since this is a pretty common problem. And Sean, do we have an idea of why anti-vaxxing is a modern problem?
Well, actually, there's a long history of it, and it goes back to religious movements and so on. But the modern strain of the anti-vax movement is basically, it starts around, I mean, people often talk about a certain academic article that came out in...
the one that's been debunked over and over and over.
But actually, it predates that and extends beyond simply the MMR vaccine to other vaccines, even including things such as the...
measles, mumps, rubella.
Yeah, right, which is the main one that article focused on. But it also extends to even things along the influenza and other vaccines. And so the anti-vax movement is diverse, and there are diverse communities that believe in these ideas. But basically, that article was often looked at as a sort of starting point of the modern movement.
And Sinead, that article, again, has been debunked. The scientist behind it has been discredited. So why is it still alive?
Well, oftentimes you have celebrities and other individuals coming out who are not scientists who are still supporting these claims. And so individuals are not as...
Okay, but why do we believe the celebrity and not the scientist?
Well, that is a longer conversation. Why do celebrities hold more water in the society than our scientists? And I think we can really start with K-12 education and educating people about STEM and Congress as well.
Okay, so let's talk about, you go back in some of your research to things like the Tuskegee syphilis study. Tell me why that's relevant when we're talking about things like anti-vaccine. How do you connect those dots?
Sure, so the Tuskegee syphilis study is probably the most well-known example of medical abuse in unscrupulous researchers.
In which they injected people with syphilis.
So it's actually a fallacy where people were not injected, people actually had syphilis, and they studied the effects of syphilis on black males in Tuskegee, Alabama, and they compared them to populations who were white males. And the unethical piece of this came when a treatment for syphilis came out and the men were not given the treatment. And so oftentimes we cite this study as one of the early occurrences where unequal treatment was given to individuals, and people will often quote it, but often think that the men were injected with syphilis, and that's just not correct.
But you point to it as a beginning of distrust of authority figures and especially of government.
It's one of the most well-known, but it does date back further than Tuskegee, where during slavery we have something called night riders. And these are stories where people would go and into the slave quarters and use slaves for medical research.
So, Sean, then this distrust of government, can we trace that also with some of the conspiracy theories that half of Americans believe in?
Oh, yeah. That's actually in the statistical models that we've run in our various, academic journal articles and so on that we've done. This political distrust actually is one of the main predictors. And statistically, your views of government generally is one of the most strongest predictors of you holding anti-vax beliefs, particularly holding anti-vax behaviors, like actually not just sort of believing in it, but actually truly not vaccinating your children. Another thing that's interesting is that we found in other strands of our research is that there's multiple political conspiracies, such as Barack Obama not being born in the United States, or George W. Bush somehow having knowledge of the 9/11 attacks. These are called birtherism and trutherism. In some of our recent research, we found that oftentimes people will believe in all of these theories. They'll be anti-vaxxers and birthers and truthers simultaneously, which would not make sense if it was some sort of political animus, but would make sense if there's some predisposition to having to holding conspiratorial beliefs.
So what he's talking about, that Sinead, is that you, it kind of sounds like we're talking about two different groups. There's one that are just prone to believe in conspiracy theories, right?
Right.
And then there's people who just distrust authority figures.
Correct. And then sometimes those groups do converge.
And that they converge at medical conspiracy theories.
Absolutely.
But this is upsetting, Sean, because what you're saying implies that as the Americans' opinion of Congress goes lower, and I don't know that it can go all that much lower, they're less likely to believe the CDC, for example?
Right. And one of the interesting things we found from our research is that a traditional approach to something like this would be to apply more and more credentials when you speak and to communicate. Well, I'm this expert that's evolved with this important institution, and I graduated from these
multiple PhDs.
And we found is the more credentials you add, the more you're signaling to these groups that you're a part of the establishment that's oppressing them, or the way they view it as some sort of oppressive force. And so that the more credentials you add, actually the more you're sort of, it in a sense, backfires, because you're more signaling to them that we're that you are the part of the group that they don't like, that they don't trust.
This is also complicated, and either of you can take this. It's complicated by people like, say, Dr. Oz, who put forth claims which are not medically proven, and in fact sometimes are medically false. And so, as you say, this is somebody with very credible credentials who is then saying to them something to them that can't be trusted. How does that complicate the belief in conspiracy theories?
I think it goes back to my earlier point. Dr. Oz is a celebrity, so he's in our houses every day, and we trust him and we see him. And so oftentimes we have more exposure to Dr. Oz than our primary care physicians.
So then, Sean, then what about insurance companies, which are private? Does that also feed into people's distrust?
Well, certainly attitudes towards these things also correlate with suspicion over, for example, the Affordable Care Act and these kinds of things, the expansion of government involvement in healthcare. If you don't trust government, then that actually sort of feeds into this. But I think I wanted to sort of add on to what was being said previously. This also points to a potential solution to this, is if you can find some person that has legitimacy within these different groups, not, it could be a celebrity or something like this, but what that really amounts to is they have trust in that celebrity. They don't trust.
Wait, so we need a medical version of Bill Nye or Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Something like that. That the people actually, so that someone that they, for whatever reason, can communicate with them. And actually, when some of our research, we've looked at parents and basically social network members, so that they don't trust the medical authorities, but they may trust someone. They might have legitimacy within their social network. And so we tried to actually give information about vaccines to social networks, and that seemed to be somewhat effective.
What, Sinead, you were going to add to that?
Yeah, so I think as researchers and healthcare providers, we often have to get into the community. So I think that it's important that the community trust us, and this is why Tuskegee was so successful, because the methods that they used for that study was to use community workers and really do outreach and care for the individuals above and beyond just the study. And so they gained the trust of those individuals in the study, and that's what we need to do through community-based research and healthcare.
Is there always going to be a certain number of Americans that believe medical conspiracy theory, Sean?
There always has been. Like I said, it goes back to...
So it's not worse now than it has been in the past?
Oh, it's worse now, yeah.
Oh.
And what's interesting is that even if you look at it, sort of survey data, you would think that something like the measles outbreak, which was very well covered at Disneyland, you know, a few years ago, you would think something like that would be sort of this watershed moment that would change these people's attitudes.
The reason you think that is because doctors said if you do not have herd immunity, people are going to get the measles, and then we didn't have herd immunity and people got the measles.
Right. Yeah.
So why didn't that have that effect?
Well, we probably still have herd immunity, but basically what happened there was the sort of younger children aren't able to get the vaccine up until like sort of 18 months and this kind of thing. And so there are other people. We're probably not at a level where we've lost herd immunity yet, but it's a dangerous level. And anyway, the point is that we do have people that aren't vaccinated and then they were able to get it. And so, but you know, why that didn't do it is because maybe people distrust the information that the media is providing them. Maybe they don't believe this is effective, or maybe they simply believe that the risk of autism is greater than the risk of getting the measles.
Okay, so we got to wrap up here, but I want to keep track. They don't trust the government. They don't trust doctors. They don't trust me as the media, but they'll trust celebrities. Great. Sean Ritchie is a political science professor at Georgia State University. Sinead Young is an associate professor of psychology at Morehouse College. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought.
I am a hurricane, listen to yourself, turn world, serve its own needs, dummy, serve your own needs, feed it up an ox, speak, grunt, no strength, the ladder starts to clatter with fear, fight down, high wire in a fire, represented seven games in a government for hire in a combat site. Let the Western come in a hurry with the fury.
You know, sometimes the public's fear of deadly diseases and threats is justified. Take the bubonic plague, for example. It's estimated to have killed 60% of Europe's population in the 14th century, as depicted in the film Black Death from 2010.
The pestilence claimed no higher purpose, and those who had survived our swords that day soon fell foul of its scythe. They were not protected by the witch. They were simply remote. And once the pestilence crossed their marsh, it killed them too.
But some of our fears are irrational.
You used to call me on my cell phone, late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone.
Cell phones are a good example of this. They've long been thought to, by some people, to emit high levels of radiation. Some people even worry their use may be linked to brain tumors. But the latest research shows no increase in brain cancer among cell phone users, and radiation only shows up in very, very low levels. While people do like to focus on extremes, my next guest says the real killers in our midst are often ignored. Terry Pachacek is a professor of health management and policy at Georgia State University. Good morning, Terry, and welcome back to the CDC.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So one of the things we heard often during the Ebola crisis forever, for example, which scared a lot of people, was that this is how humankind will end, some kind of disease which is going to wipe out the planet, and it's going to be like that game Plague Inc. How do you separate some of the real fears from the irrational fears?
We're always afraid of the unknown and the uncertain and the different, but the reality is that the common and the familiar is what is going to kill us. It is the common behaviors of tobacco, alcohol, overeating, and lack of exercise that actually are going to continue to kill the vast majority of people prematurely. For example, as economies are emerging around the world and we're dealing with the maternal and child health and infectious disease, very successfully helping some of those economies, what is happening is they're rapidly taking on the premature death of caused by tobacco, alcohol, overeating, and lack of exercise. Things like traffic deaths are a leading cause of death in young adults in many parts of the world.
So let's talk about obesity first, because I wonder how much obesity is a very real threat for people. Is that something that people can look to and say, look, this is a really possible cause of my death?
Well, first of all, lack of exercise, poor diet, and all these things that happen that come from that, diabetes and all the other food-related types of diseases, absolutely are exploding. One of the facts, though, that we came up from when you were talking to Dr. Frieden, is that the food industry, the alcohol industry, and the fossil fuel industries and all learn from tobacco. They are now the merchants of doubt. They have the same
merchants of doubt.
The merchants of doubt. The merchants of death. And what they have done is learn the techniques of PR. They have the same lawyers, they have the same lobbyists as the tobacco industry, who's had 50 years of learning how to confuse people from making decisions. And alcohol does it as effectively as tobacco. Now the climate change people are taking on the same kind of confusion of the science. Let's go to the nutrition. Michael Pollan has some basic rules. Don't eat processed food. Don't eat anything with more than 5 ingredients. Don't eat any food your grandmother doesn't recognize as food. Don't eat in your car. Don't eat where you buy gas. Some very basic kinds of rules that would move us toward a more simpler diet, a more natural diet, and would disrupt the big food corporations and their profit streams, who are just as bad as tobacco.
Okay, so let's bring in another voice into this conversation. My guest right now is Terry Bahacek, a professor of health management and policy at Georgia State University. So let's invite in David Weiss, who cast his vote for antibiotic resistance as the top threat to public health today. David is the director of the Emory Antibiotic Resistance Center. It's good to have you.
Thanks. Hi, it's good to be here.
So antibiotic resistance, are you talking about things like MRSA?
Yes, absolutely.
And why is that such a danger?
Right. So we rely on antibiotics to really have the healthcare system that we have and are used to. So before antibiotics were discovered, surgeries weren't really possible. Things that we now take as great medical advances like transplants or cancer chemotherapy, premature infants being able to survive, all of those things rely on antibiotics being there to stop bacterial infection.
Right, so before antibiotics, you could get a cut in your hand and it could end up being fatal.
Yes.
So antibiotic resistance, which has been coming around, we have seen signs of it for decades now.
Yes.
Worse than it has been 10, 20, 30 years ago?
Yes, absolutely. And in part because we were complacent and didn't pay enough attention to it, basically. So it has crept up on us. The bacteria are always trying to survive and evolve to resist antibiotics, but we as a society stopped developing new antibiotics for decades, and in that time we fell behind the bacteria.
So I'm not trying to encourage you to be an alarmist, but are we reaching the point against when a simple surgery or a simple cut can actually become a major health crisis?
Right. I would say that there are certain patients in hospitals today that are infected with strains of bacteria that are untreatable. And they are, those individuals are essentially in a post-antibiotic world. At the same time, that is luckily not the majority of cases at this point, but it could be if we don't take a lot of significant action now.
So, Terry, here we have a very different, this is a medically based problem, and you're talking about lifestyle based problems. What do you think is more likely to cause people a threat?
Well, it's the reality, if you talk about the numbers, it's actually the common familiar that is still killing the most people. We consider tobacco control a great public health success. Save 8 million premature deaths since 64 Surgeon General report. But we pass by the fact that since we released the report, 1 million Americans have died prematurely and 12 million people worldwide. And so in terms of absolute numbers, tobacco, alcohol, all the common aspects of inactivity, bad foods are killing more people. I completely agree. What am I concerned about for my family? The types of things that are unknown and things like overuse of antibiotics that are causing drug-resistant strains, which are scary, which are terrible. But the interesting thing about the common and familiar is that while we are concerned about doing the research on these scary types of things, there's a very perverse, like Ebola, like drug-resistant to strains of all these bacteria. But the reality is that in public health, being successful makes you at greater risk for losing your funding. Let me say that again. Being successful and cost-effective means you lose your budget. So what is happening right now to the OSH budget for the TIPS campaign, one of the most effective, cost-effective campaigns, the media campaigns of anti-smoking? They want to take the budget to zero, take away $100 million of an effective campaign. What are we doing when we use our science to prove something is cost-effective, promote that, and that leads to a cut in funding? That is the kind of perversity that goes on all the time that makes CDC impossible to do its job.
Now, here's the thing, and it seems to be a common strain this whole hour, strain, forgive the pun, here at the CDC, and that's the thing of the problem of education, because there seems to be a real problem between our scientists and the general public. And I'm going to put this to you, David, because one of the problems of antibiotic resistance is that people want antibiotics. They go in with what may be a virus, but they want their doctor to prescribe them some antibiotics. How do you overcome that?
Right. I think that's just through education. And the other aspect of that.
But wait, I want to call you on that because we've been trying to educate people about that for at least 20 years.
Right.
It hasn't worked.
Right. So I was going to say, people have to know that antibiotics do not kill viruses. So if they have a viral infection, the antibiotics are not going to be useful. But the other thing that doctors need and patients need as well is a diagnostic test that's rapid, that you go to the doctor and you'll know if you're infected with a bacterium or a virus. And if you could tell a patient with almost certainty that they have a viral infection, then they probably would be more open to not taking antibiotics if you explain to them that they're not going to be effective and you won't prescribe
them. How close are we to getting a test like that?
I would say we don't have one in place now for sure, and they're at the research
stage. Not on the horizon.
Yeah, I mean, the good thing about diagnostic tests is that they are more rapid than bringing a new drug to market. So they can become...
In terms of, you don't have to, in getting FDA approval.
You have to get FDA approval, but it's all a faster process, and the development is faster, potentially. So it could be on the horizon faster than new drugs.
So then what about education for the things you're talking about, Terry? Because certainly we've known for a good long time that eating a hamburger every day from McDonald's, for example, is not good for you. It's not like somebody thinks that's great and healthy. So how do we bridge that education gap for the things, lifestyle choices people make that might kill them?
Well, for example, that's a great example of the hamburger and the chicken patty and these types of processed foods that are sold in the fast foods cheaper than the healthier foods. One of the things is that in the late 1990s, Governor Lawton Child brought a number of us together in the governor's mansion in Florida and said, let's bring together all of our public health knowledge and our media knowledge and all of our experience across multiple disciplines, and we created the Truth Campaign, mostly telling children why they were being manipulated and making their anti-authoritism turned against the killers of the big industry. We need to do that in food. The concentrated feeding operations, the animal abuse, the environmental abuse of the current food system needs to be turned into an emotional issue. Adolescents will drive by the fast food not because of health, but because they are disgusted by the food system, by the abuse within the corporate food system. Just like the adolescents passed the pack of cigarettes because they were mad at the industry. We need to do that in alcohol. We need to do that in food. We need to do that in built environment. And we particularly need to do it in climate change. We need to build the emotional side of it. It is not an intellectual issue. It's an emotional issue. The average person makes decision more on emotion than on fact. Whenever we blame the victim and say that they are or don't have enough information, we're playing into the corporate model that has been fed by the tobacco industry, creating the merchants of death.
I'm speaking with Terry Bahacek, professor of health management and policy at Georgia State University, and David Weiss is director of the Emory Antibiotic Resistance Center. That's the second time that you've mentioned climate change. Are you listing that among the things that might kill us?
Of course it will. This is the interplay between the disciplines. One of the ways that the tropical diseases, the unknown new emerging infectious diseases are going to break out is because of climate change. One of the aspects of that we don't realize is that the food systems and all the types of things that are going to cause malnutrition, are going to cause many other types of problems, are going to be driven by climate change. The disruptions in the stability of nations in terms of civil war and strife are going to be caused by fights over war, water, and food. Climate change is going to have much bigger effects than most people are realizing, and it's going to drive many of the kind of things that we are most afraid of are going to happen because of the climate change. And the interesting thing is, like the tobacco, we knew what the answer was 50 years ago, and we're still not doing it. In climate change, are we going to wait 50 years until the disasters happen before we're going to do the simple solutions? The simple solutions for tobacco, alcohol, and many of these things were much easier to do 50 years ago. And if we would have applied our knowledge then, we would have saved billions of premature deaths.
So, David, how does climate change possibly complicate infection?
Right. So with the example of Zika, if, as the climate warms, the mosquitoes that spread the virus can reach new parts of the world and they can spread disease to new parts of the world.
So that makes it even worse if we have both climate change increasing infection and then antibiotic resistance.
Right, with the caveat that Zika is a virus, and so antibiotics
exactly.
wouldn't be
Don't help
effective
you.
Against those.
Mosquitoes spread plenty of things.
Right, plenty of things, absolutely. So it's
in no way
a good thing
at
all. I would just say, going back to the issue of food, that's a big issue in antibiotic resistance as well.
Because so, the food, those who raise the animals are using antibiotics as they raise them?
Right, and the worst part about that is that, so in the U.S., roughly 80% of the use of antibiotics is in farming, not in people. And interestingly, that most of that is not even to treat sick animals. That's for growth promotion. And the worst part about that is that it's very low levels of antibiotics are used in animal feed. And through a process that we still don't totally understand, that promotes animals to gain weight. But if you wanted to come up with a recipe to create antibiotic resistance, that is one of the best ways to do it. So you're using a ton of antibiotics and you're using very low levels, which basically train the bacteria how to become resistant without actually threatening them enough to kill them.
Great. So what we've learned is that what was going to kill us is us, basically. We're going to kill ourselves. David Weiss is director of the Emory Antibiotic Resistance Center. Terry Bahacek, bringing the joy, professor of health management and policy at Georgia State University. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is our show for the day. We have a lot of people to thank here at the CDC. Sarah Bedrosian, Tracy Stewart, Miriam Falco, Judy Gant, Ronald Lawrence. Also thanks to Lane Sterrett, Tom Barkley, Emily Hackshaw. And of course, thanks to all of our guests and today's live audience. Thanks you. Thanks to you. So what questions do you still have about the CDC, and please don't ask where the zombies are. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or post your response to Facebook. Happy 70th birthday to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for today and the week. That is On Second Thought from GPP News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend.
No dairy, no sweets, only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school, my household smell like soul food, bruh. Curry falafel, barbecue tofu, no fish, no candy bars, no cigarettes, only fresh squeezed juice from...